All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz of the CFRU news team. And Adam, I'm having a bit of a crisis because...
Oh, no.
If the Prime Minister is an extremist wacko...
Yeah.
I want to know what that makes me. I really do in the scheme of the universe, because I don't know anymore. I don't know anything anymore. If that's where we're at with that,
can't
even.
You could tell that it was a really well choreographed slip of the tongue, because they had an email fundraiser out there in minutes.
Oh, amazing! Like,
can you believe that Greg Fraser, a liberal, threw me out of the parliament for calling Justin Trudeau a wacko? What?
Yeah, show me the money.
Yeah. By the way, we could use some of your money. I hate it.
Sounds a bit Trump style, doesn't it? I guess we'll probably talk about this future date.
you think so? I hate it. Thanks. Leave Republican stuff on that other side of the border. But anyway, we'll talk about other stuff this week. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. Which this week will be, speaking of liberals, oddly enough, Ward 6 City Councilor Dominique O'Rourke, who's going to talk about the part that she played in the Health and Housing Symposium that took place a couple of weeks ago, and her plans to join another dysfunctional government in Ottawa. Just kidding, sort of. Anyway, that's going to be at the bottom half of the hour. Before that, we're going to talk about a few news items from the last week, including drugs. You know them, you love them. No, just kidding. The BC government is making a move, though, to end their efforts to decriminalize drugs and reverse that. And that may be too soon to call off that effort, but we're going to talk about that and the effects on people who use substances coming up. First, campus protests. You know them, you love them. Well, we certainly do, and Scotty and I both have pass in that world.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting this past week seeing mainstream American media outlets cover campus protests like it's 1968. We're partying like it's 1968. Interestingly, Hamilton Hall on the campus of Columbia University in New York City, taken over. It was taken over in 1968 as part of the anti-Vietnam protests. In this case, it is protesters who are concerned about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. It seems to have gotten lost in the shuffle. 34,000 Palestinians have been killed, 2/3 of them women and children. But this week, it's the kids who were wrong in protesting this and everything. And I don't know about you, Scotty. I've been kind of shocked by some of the coverage of what's been going on. We really seem to have kind of lost the plot on this one. We're yelling at the kids instead of yelling at the person who's gotten 1.5 million Palestinians all walled up in one single city after laying waste to the rest of Gaza. It seems like there's something a little out of whack here.
Yeah, and that's a really good point right out of the gate, because in a lot of ways, not the protests necessarily, but the coverage of them does distract from what is going on, like everything you said there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that they shouldn't happen, but it's obvious. You mentioned Columbia there, and the takeover of the buildings is kind of a repeat of the 60s. But it also proves that through the generations, the police still love to crack heads when the administration asked them to. Did you see that shot of the ramp? I've never seen anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't use ladders. They just have this special ramp now where they just ramming speed through the window and take everything apart. Certainly widespread. It's hard to keep track of all of the places. I've seen a list of 50 universities. I've seen a list of 100 universities. Those protests have spread to the north. There's one in particular, McGill in Montreal. The Sorbonne, which was also involved in the 1968 protests. So it's, I was going to say, a little bit of a rerun. There are parallels, of course, but not just Vietnam. At Columbia University in the 60s, I don't want to get too deep into this, but it also involved race and segregation. In some ways, you could apply to the situation in Gaza, because that is, you know, to quote the song of the day, there are battle lines being drawn. And we've seen that particularly at the University of California, where there was a, you know, they always say there's been an outbreak of violence. But the outbreak of violence is usually, as I said, is the police coming in and cracking heads. That's where the violence comes from. But it was unique in California in that it was, there was counter protesters showed up, don't really know whether it's sort of amorphous as to where they're from, and started out, sent somebody to the hospital and people were injured. There was a fight. Then the police came in. And of course, the administration will be happy with that, because then that gives them the excuse to just clear everybody out. It's like violence, no safety. They always play the safety card. Even if there isn't an actual threat, it's like safety equals. Whether safety involves optics and no, we don't actually really want to see this or hear from you, then they'll just clear everybody out.
I think it's what's not helping either. And speaking of like rhyming with 68, the Democratic National Convention's in Chicago this year. So everything's kind of lining up.
Wow. Yeah, it's a rerun.
Yeah. But it speaks to a real leadership paralysis on these campuses, because Manoush Shafiq, who is the president of Columbia, her background includes being an executive at the London School of Economics, but also like an executive at the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So this plays into, this kind of plays into my point that a lot of this is kind of like donor driven. We've seen that since pro-Palestinians protests started in October after the terrorist attack on October 7th, and when the operations in Gaza began, like a lot of big money donors, you know, were saying, well, I believe I won't donate to my alma mater, this Ivy League university, so long as the kids there are siding with the Palestinians. And so a lot of it is donor relations. A lot of it is like the fact that this has become another culture war front, like Mike Johnson and all like the worst blatherskites from the Republican Party went to Columbia last week, like including Elise Stefanik, who has never met a culture war she didn't want a piece of. And you know, it's become a political wedge. You know, there were those university presidents that went to Congress, and because they were doing like the mealy-mouthed lawyer answer on anti-Semitism and student speech, you know, two of them ended up losing their jobs. So there's that part of it too. And I think also, you know, when we're talking about these power structures, you know, whether we're talking about university presidents, the American legacy media, you know, moderates in the Democratic Party, far right people in the Republican Party, it's always been cheap, easy, and effective to beat up on young people who are progressive and more likely than not people of color. It's just they're a cheap target. You can go, well, look at these kids, they don't get the real world. And, you know, then you can go down to the press club and it's ass slaps and high fives about, you know, you're not biased because you were tough on those progressive kids. And I think, you know, that goes right back to the start of the war. Like, I remember Congresswoman Jayapal, who is one of the squad and is a person of color, was on the CNN Sunday show, and Dana Bash is like raking her all the coals, like, so I want you to, like, basically, like, I want you to say out loud the following words: rape is not a weapon of war. And it's, of course, you know, this congresswoman who is like a progressive feminist is not in favor of rape, especially up to and including especially as a weapon of war. But, you know, it's this gotcha kind of moment. And then, you know, a couple of weeks earlier, this same anchor is talking to somebody like Nancy Mace, who's a liar and a seditionist and a pig, frankly, because remember, Nancy Mace was, you know, the one who got up at the National Prayer Breakfast doing this Andrew Dice Clay bit about how she had to, like, push her fiance off of her in order to get to the prayer breakfast on time. But, you know, Dana Bash, who was the anchor, is like, to her, Nancy Mace is a badass woman of DC, but Congresswoman Jayapal is, you know, someone who is like this close to thinking rape's okay if you're a Hamas terrorist using it to terrorize an Israeli person. So it's, I mean, this has kind of been part of the process of this. If you're young, if you're progressive, if you're a person of color, we can beat you up, rhetorically speaking, literally speaking. And, you know, to get back to the rhyming of it all, too, like we look back at 68 and like we look at those young people as righteous. They were on the right side. Vietnam was an empty hole through which like a generation was like ground through that had no point at all, that had no end game, that had no purpose other than to be a meat grinder for a generation of young people. How is that different from today? I mean, are we going to be looking back in 2074 and looking back at these protests? Like, you know, those kids who took over the hall to stop the slaughter in Gaza, they were good. They did the right thing, you know. And then, of course, they'll be yelling at the kids for being anti-war somewhere else, like on Mars, because they believe that Martians have the right to manifest destiny or something. I don't know. But it just, I think the rhyming of this is something that also stinks.
Well, and that is the heavy parallel, is that, I mean, some of the companies, a lot of them are different because they're tech companies. These are the companies that are investing in Israel and supplying mm-hmm. Israel weapons, but also technology. For example, Google is one.
Mm-hmm.
Lockheed Martin, I'm pretty sure they were around in the Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these, you know, contribute to the endowments of various places. Columbia in particular, there was American Friends Service Committee did it. The Quakers did a breakdown and I'm almost certain that they were the ones that did the breakdown back in the day as well, of like, here's who's contributing to this, to the endowment. And by the way, they're making a fortune on what's mm-hmm. going on in Gaza. So that is almost a direct parallel to what was going on back in the day, other than the tech aspect. Maybe it was IBM. Maybe I shouldn't say that because we don't know that for sure. But anyway, there's certain parallels for sure. But going back to what you were saying about certain things that are being said in the media, to me, it's pretty rich, some of the whining coming from the free speechers, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, remember a few years ago, it's the woke left are controlling everything on campuses, mm-hmm. to liberal, all of those things, smaller liberal in the American case, let's say. Those arguments were being made back in the 60s as well. In fact, there's mm-hmm. an argument that everything that happened in the 60s is why these institutions are so liberal now and all the kids are woke.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, we see I wasn't sure if I was going to go in this direction, but business with Danielle Smith and the overreach that they're trying to have in Alberta over, we're looking for the ideological balance, right?
That's a lot of overreach in Alberta these days.
They mean more conservatives and less people that might have sympathies for Gaza and human rights and all of those things. Yeah. But yeah, maybe we shouldn't really go there, but it's you think back to 2017, the Tiki Torch fascists did their thing. No police came. When the riot happened at UCLA, you know, the police, they weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were there. They're like, oh, I guess we better arrest people. And I think, what are they up to? I think I saw 400 arrests, but a lot of that will just be people that are detained and let go. But then, of course, there's going to be punitive administrative things will happen to certain people that are seen as leaders, as happened in 1968 as well. So there will be this. I think certain people have been expelled in places.
Sure.
And that, again, there's just so many, we can't really stay on top of who did what to whom, but there's definitely suspensions and probations and people not being allowed to write exams, and which, you know, is interesting, because some of the argument, I saw the governor of New York saying, or no, mayor of New York. I'll say the governor of New York. One of the two saying that most of the people that were in Hamilton Hall are outsiders.
Yeah, they that was
come from the outside. It's like, do you have evidence of that? Like,
no, there was no evidence.
Right. And again, I'm going to say it. This is the same as 1968. That was the exact. Oh, these damn dirty hippies are coming in from the outside and they're wrecking everything. It's like, Well, how are you suspending a bunch of students and arresting a bunch of students then if they're outsiders?
Right. I mean, there's a couple of things. One is like the disingenuous of the free speech, like Greg Abbott, who had the Texas legislature pass a law that said we need to have free speech rights on campus. Well, what he meant was like free speech for people on the right and less speech for people on the left. So, I mean, that's one thing. The other thing is, like, are there outside agitators who are probably going to these protests? Yes, because they forced the protests off campus for a bit into the streets of New York, where you mix with like members of the public. So, and you know, if you make friends with somebody on campus, they can let you on campus. That's not a problem. So is it possible there are outside agitators? Of course it's possible. And the other thing is, like, is it possible that there's some anti-Semitism on campus? Of course it's possible. You know why? Because there's anti-Semitism anywhere. But the key part of this, and actually there were like a lot of different, I was listening to a podcast, and they were somebody like talking to different student protesters, and it's just like a rainbow of different issues, from the war to like general Palestinian liberation to like, you know, working issues, labor issues on the campus, and also divestment too, because I mean that goes back to the 60s. They weren't just angry about Vietnam; they were angry about Columbia being involved in like weapons manufacturing and ROTC being on campus, and like universities being a pipeline to serve in the military. So I mean, it's just too complicated and to crush us down to like it's just about this one thing. And if you want to say there's anti-Semitism on campus, yeah, you're probably right. But that's because there's anti-Semitism everywhere. So I don't know what any of this proves other than we still don't listen to young people, even though, I mean, they were right about Iraq. They were right about, you know, nuclear proliferation in the 80s. They were right about Vietnam.
Segregation. You know,
segregate. Like, yeah, how many times are we going to not listen to young people? And there was a good Substack. I hope I don't get his name wrong. Anand Giridharidis, where he's like, we should stop expecting like student protests to be perfect. Like, it's okay for student protests, like not to have like to not nail the talking points. That like university is a place you go to learn and grow and make connections and be exposed to new ideas. So if you are not 100% on an issue, that's okay. You know. It just seems like a complete and total overreaction. But of course, like somebody like Eric Adams, who was a former police officer, is a hammer, so every problem is a nail. Speaking of police, we're going to move along to British Columbia, where the BC government has asked Health Canada to undo some of these provisions that allow for the decriminalization of drugs. In the province, there have been a lot of concerns lately. And actually, when you dig into it, a lot of this seems to be pretty disingenuous about, you know, hospitals being like zones where drug dealing is going on out in the open and doctors are walking through clouds of fentanyl. But regardless, you know, this has kind of become our own culture work, as we kind of alluded to at the top of the show. Pierre Poilievre has seized on this, called criminalization a wacko policy, and called the Prime Minister a wacko for supporting it. What's interesting, though, this policy has only been in effect for a year. It was part of a three-year pilot, so it remains to be seen how ineffective or effective it is, but this has gotten pretty nasty pretty quick.
And this is one of those areas where there's overlap, because federal government has certain control over drugs, particular drugs. But the province is, of course, in charge of health.
Yep.
And this is the great question and the balancing act between, is this actually a public safety issue or is it a health issue?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it's being used by certain people, as mentioned, to ride that law and order wave, let's call it, that conservatives love so much. Yeah. And I'm going to name them because that's where it's coming from. Doug Ford had to chime in on this, saying because Toronto is thinking about doing something similar and he's against hard drugs being you know, freely available, but he's forgetting that if it was his brother in an alleyway or something, that the police would absolutely have the right to haul him in because there's a possibility that he might have been smoking crack in one of his drunken stupors. Not to beat on the late Rob Ford too much, but there's an example of like not quite getting it. There's somebody in the family who would benefit from the, let's say, the health aspect of this, in that if there was, you know, clean supply or the ability, I guess when you're talking millionaire, Rob Ford did go to detox. I didn't want to talk about the Fords too much, but just wanted to make that point. And that now Saskatchewan is piling on, right? This is terrible. It's failure, everything that BC's doing. And of course, but they're trying again, the same with Polyev, to pin this on Trudeau. And we know the problem is much greater than any possible wacko thing that the prime minister may or may not have done. The feds loosened up the laws so the provinces could go in the direction that they needed to or wanted to. So is Ottawa the root of the problem? I don't think so necessarily. And there's so much to this. Everything from the fact that heroin isn't as available now, so most of the drugs, street drugs, are synthetic. That's how people are getting their hit. I heard one street worker saying that there is no heroin on the streets of BC. Somebody who works with these people said, no, it's all questionable sourced things from a lab. So there's no quality control.
Right.
So there are more problems. There are more people dying. There's more people overdosing. If you criminalize that, people possessing that stuff, just using that as an excuse to get people out of a doorway. It's like, we don't want to look at them. This is what it's about. It's part of what it's about. It's like, we don't want to look at this anymore. So could you please remove these people? It doesn't solve the problem, but at least they were getting clean supply and not necessarily having to experience the carceral system for just taking drugs, then it just snowballs from there. There's no fix if you're just locking people up, which is what they want.
And the Doug Ford example is what's really interesting here, because his brother, I think his older brother Randy, had substance abuse issues, and so did his sister. Like, that whole family, like, you think there would be more compassion. But I guess, you know, just say no. And that was the lesson Doug took away, because I could...
Alleged hash dealer.
I was going to say alleged. He dealt. He didn't use. Allegedly. But yeah, I mean, that's interesting too. Part of this also is, we only go halfway with these like harm reduction efforts. Like, and I asked Lloyd about this the last time he was on. It's like the federal government keeps like announcing these pilot programs, and they're successful, and then, you know, they turn around and it's like, okay, great. We have a successful program. Good luck finding funding to make it permanent. And like, nobody has any idea where to go. And like, all like traditional sources of funding are all tapped. Cities are tapped. Provinces are tapped. You know, you create successful programs that end up, you know, spending all their time looking for funding instead of doing the thing that made them successful. And you also have these jurisdictional cross rifts. You know, the federal government is the one who's like letting this pilot program go, but ultimately is responsibility of the provincial government. And then it just becomes a matter of sort of like appearances. And, you know, if you see somebody, I mean, first of all, people are using substances in plain view, because if they get into trouble, that then they will be found immediately. Otherwise you end up like that poor person who was found in Royal City Park last summer.
Yeah,
who had been like dead for days.
Walked by there often. Had no idea.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, you know, that's why you do it out in the open, and that's also why you have like the consumption and treatment sites and these other things. But it really does seem like, because there's election in October in BC, it's going to be an uphill climb for the NDP, because they've been in power so long. So they're another government that's kind of long in the tooth. They have these right wing ideologues, BC United, nipping at their heels. They're going to be, you know, they're probably not going to be as compassionate with their responses on substance use and addictions and treatments. And it seems to me that, you know, whether it's Polly Ever, whether it's Doug Ford, it's all backwards looking. It's like, remember when you could walk down the street and not see people using substances, as if, you know, there was ever a time people weren't abusing substances.
Oh, yeah, it was just alcohol, so it was okay, right?
Well, that's, I mean, that's it. But the other thing is too, that there were like years of circumstances that led to this. Like, this didn't happen overnight. This didn't happen because of COVID. There were years of like of disinterest and not funding things, not looking at investing in alternatives, like just writing people scripts for painkillers and letting them get addicted and letting them get hooked, as opposed to like spending the time, effort, and energy and money to make sure that they have proper health treatment. Like, we did this pound by pound, yard for yard, and now because it wasn't solved easy, we're going to go back to the nightstick and the handcuffs, and we're going to pay for that too in its own way. Like, putting, like, just throwing people behind bars and forgetting about them, we pay for that too.
Yeah, but when you're on the blue team and also rooting for Team Blue, meaning the cops, that's what you get. That's, you know, we it needs law and order, it needs more police, it needs more jails. That's not what needs to happen. And then going back to what you said about programs and being cut, let's go local for a second. The Sanguine Van, right, do excellent work, harm reduction and reversing overdoses, all those kinds of things, trying to keep that population as healthy as they possibly can and out in the streets. And that funding was cut. Was like, where is this going to come from? We don't know. Something that works, and in the scheme of things, not that expensive,
Well, just
right?
to offer a correction, it didn't run out. It ended. That was one of those pilot projects
Well,
that the funding ends, and then, you know, they're spending all their time trying to find another
exactly.
source of
So, you
funding.
know,
So,
why should that end?
right.
Why not, when police get suspended, maybe, you know, not pay them and then put that money into, right? Maybe that's a bad example, Adam. I don't know. But the money has
Maybe.
come from somewhere. And like there are places in the States where I'm going to say Portland, where they tax on marijuana products, on cannabis tax, goes directly into health programs, exactly like the Sanguine Van.
Yeah, that would be interesting and innovative, and we can't have any of that in Canada.
No.
We're gonna have to take a quick break, leaving it on that note, and we're gonna come right back with our interview with Dominique O'Rourke. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
New album from Cadence Weapon. It's called Roller Coaster. And that was a heck of a roller coaster song. You may have guessed it's called My Computer, because I think he just drops every single thing to do with these infernal machines from the beginning of time to now. So, gotta love it.
Maybe the ultimate Cadence Weapon is his laptop. That wasn't a great joke, but all right.
No, it's, yeah, you're not wrong.
It's fine. We'll move on. Moving on. So we caught up with Ward 6 City Councilor Dominique O'Rourke earlier this week. There was a big health and housing symposium a couple of weeks ago. It was the third day of 3 days that they ran it, Guelph and Wellington County. Dominique was there. There was a whole section of the day where I was not, as a member of the media, an active part, because everyone was like kind of at separate tables. So I wanted to ask Dominique about what was going on at her tables, and we get into that. And we're also going to get into her federal campaign. If you don't know, Dominique O'Rourke is running to be the Liberal nominee for the next federal election. So last week we had or was it 2 weeks ago? We had Janice Folk Dawson on. She has been acclaimed as NDP nominee. Dominique will be running in a nomination contest against presumably other nominees, and that vote will happen sometime later this year, I assume. And so we're going to dig into that and why she wants to be Guelph's MP and all that other stuff. And why she wants to leave our precious city council. It makes me sad. Anyway, we're going to get into all that with Dominique O'Rourke starting right now. So Dominique O'Rourke, thank you so much for joining us again.
Always happy to be here.
I think we last saw each other in person at the Health and Housing Symposium a couple of weeks ago. You were lucky in that you got to take part in the tables. I did not, as a member of the media, and I gather there was some degree of, I guess, trying to be free of having to sort of proctor what you were saying, because there's somebody there with a pen and a pad of paper trying to write things down too. But in so much as you can, I'm wondering if you might shed some light on terms of, you know, what you talked about around some of those tables, and what, you know, sort of ideas were generated from your experience at the Health and Housing Symposium.
So we sat at two sort of action tables. What I will say is encouraging, both from the January two-day symposium and the April Health and Housing Symposium, is that everyone is adopting sort of a shared vision of the scope of the problem, particularly the health piece being new. So we often talk about those two things in isolation. So having the hospital there and their, you know, proactive solutions and lens on that. So everyone's sharing the information. There's a lot of aha moments for people who don't realize what the city has done so far in terms of housing, what some of the limitations are as well. You know, people will say, we could just take the vacant homes and convert them, right? Mm-hmm. And I understand where that's coming from, but we can't legally do that. But I think there's a real goodwill and desire to work together on some solutions. And we have seen that this community can do that. 10 Sheldale is going to open and house 34 people in the coming months. We've seen Grace Gardens, the county and the city are working together at Delhi, which will be temporary supportive housing for 27 people. So we actually have made a lot of progress, you know, even without the Health and Housing Symposium. Mm-hmm. And so what happens next is all of those ideas around the table, around advocacy, positioning. One thing that I think is really new in terms of advocacy is a broader coalition approach. So going with the chamber, mm-hmm. with the hospital, as an all of community approach for funding requests, right? And we have seen a lot of investments in housing. We haven't seen how those play out yet, but the federal government just invested $24 million here in Guelph. And so those things, I know it's not satisfying to know that they're system changes or they're enabling changes, because we want to see shovels in the ground. Well, we can't really build a whole lot for $24 million, right? Mm. Or we would serve a very small group of people. If we use the funds for enabling other solutions, that will move the needle. So I think just table stakes, better knowledge of all the programs that are going on in the community, a willingness to work together, the movement towards a joint vision. The challenge for that is going to be to stick to those priorities, right? So you can be an inch deep and a mile wide, or we can focus and really move the needle on some things, as the Home for Good campaign has done. Mm-hmm. They didn't try to be all things to all people. They said, we want these three housing projects to be built and funded, and laser focused, and got the community around that. And it worked.
It did work. And I think everyone deserves credit for that. I think, and maybe you can comment a bit on this, is I think there was a kind of build up to this, to the symposium, that we were going to come out and we were going to, like, it was going to be like a rocket coming out of it. Like, if we just get everybody together in the same room, it's going to launch out and we're going to have all these really great ideas and great solutions. And I mean, maybe that was never the intent to begin with, but I do think, and from, you know, people I've talked to, who a lot of whom work on the ground with the people who are directly affected, are just like, well, what was all that for? I'm not sure what was all that, what all that hype was about. It feels like 3 days, and I guess how are we going to see that starting to trickle out into the community, the results of the symposium?
So all of that work at all the individual tables, and I think there were 24 different topics, right? All of that will be somehow coalesced together. And what I hope happens next is that we're going to find the points of greatest leverage.
Mm-hmm.
What is different about this symposium, and I totally understand what those frontline workers are thinking, there were some new players, right? So there was the private sector there. And the private sector, in terms of 10 Cheldale, has shown up in a really big way.
Mm-hmm.
So there were different players at the table. And so I think what we need to do next is to say an investment here means these five benefits. And while we want to do all of it, you know, we won't be able to do all of it, but maybe there's an advocacy bucket. There's a, you know, direct action bucket. I know you make a face because we talk about these things all the time, but the fact is there is progress. There is progress in Guelph, right? The provincial government just funded 3 years of operating funds for 10 Cheldale, right? That's sure. progress. And
absolutely,
you know, it's not just somebody who sat down and said, I'm going to put this in the budget. It is years of advocacy and a broad coalition of advocacy that changed that. So the people who are talking and the understanding, the commitment, all of those things, some new money, right? Also, you know, some new funding from the federal government in the recently announced budget. So we don't know what all those pieces are. Who is absent, though, Adam, is the province.
Mm-hmm.
So notwithstanding the funding for 10 Cheldale, which is fantastic and appreciated, that's the gap. That's the gap on the income side for ODSP or Ontario Works. A lot of gaps. Another good governance change is we now have four members of council who sit on the County Social Services Committee. So the mayor was there. And so now Councillor Bruce Till, Councillor Downer, and I sit there as well. I think that changes the conversation.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't disagree with any of that. I think you probably get a sense of this too, is that the crisis is so massive that the systemic changes, which can take months and years to come into play, are you know, that can be kind of frustrating to people because of the immediacy of the need. And to your point about the Cheldale funding, that is something that I, as someone who follows and contributes to the news, that's like months and months and like repeated social media posts and press releases, and then it seems like, you know, it's like a pot fly, right? Like the provincial budget drops and all of a sudden, like, this thing you've been waiting till the ninth inning for this, you know, this base hit that, you know, gets three home runs. And not to throw sports metaphors at you, but it just, I don't think we really see the connections between the advocacy and the end result when we get it sometimes.
It's a good example of it working.
Well, true enough. I had another question about advocacy and whether or not it's working. Royal City Mission is scaling back services. And I remember back in December, there was a motion about referring the question about further Royal City Mission funding for the rest of the year to the symposium. Did that ever come up at all? And I guess if it did, what were the results? And if it didn't, why didn't it? Because that seems like a pretty big piece to lose at this moment.
Mm-hmm. So the funding for the Royal City Mission did not come up at any of the tables where I sat at the Health and Housing Symposium. It would have been odd for sort of a request for funding to come to that forum. There's no, you know, the big challenge, just very much like the Ontario Health Team. And I don't think that's the direction we're going in for the Health and Housing Symposium, but you have to arrive at a set of a couple of priorities, a source of funding, a decision-making mechanism. So that Health and Housing Symposium was not set up for that. Can't take motions, can't take requests for funding. That. And in a similar vein, things like, you know, the massive chronic shortage of social housing, the challenges for people with developmental disabilities to find housing, community living was short this year. I mean, a number of organizations are cutting funding, you know, the community health ban. So a number of funding challenges. So those weren't addressed individually because we're trying to generate a collective, broader plan.
Right.
So RCM, I know there's some conversations happening. I know there's some community mobilization, but your question was specifically, did it come to the health and housing symposium? It did not.
I guess it just, I realized there was no mechanism because it's not a government thing, although government was involved. I guess there was hopeful, or there was hope that some direction would come out of it, whether or not like providing RCM with more permanent sustainable funding, because I think that was part of the problem. It wasn't just like the emergency funds they got were gratefully accepted and used quite well, but I think from what Kevin Coghill was saying, that you know they have been sort of supplementing those efforts with their own internal fundraising, and they were hoping for something more permanent to come out of it, and that whether or not that was a permanent direction was something that would be discussed at the symposium and maybe come back to council or the county in terms of them sort of formalizing that funding.
Well, I would say that probably, so the forum definitely wasn't the place for that.
Mm.
Because then, you know, what about Hope House and Chalmers and all these other frontline serving organizations, all of whom do a fantastic job in community health center. So, So I think what you might see come out of a health and housing symposium is, well, there potentially, you know, could be funding for these types of organizations, or and then you need some kind of a process so that it's fair.
Mm-hmm.
So to pop up at a forum would not be a good process, right?
No,
I completely understand, and they do really important, valuable work. They do, my understanding, and it's incomplete, is that there was funding from the province through COVID to give people a place to go. There are places downtown for folks to go, including the library, including Chalmers, including Hope House. And so I think we need to see where that nets out, but they absolutely provide meals. And I understand there's an organization that's going to step in. I think it's Your Downtown Friends are going to step in to provide some support to fill that gap. It's tough. A lot of organizations are seeing fewer donors. A lot of organizations are getting year-to-year funding from the province for the provision of healthcare, for the provision of sort of legislated services. So, here's what I can tell you. I think Royal City Mission does great work. I understand that they're facing some funding challenges, and it's difficult. And it's not, unfortunately, unique.
Yes. And I appreciate all of that because there's a whole systemic part of this that, you know, the gaps are everywhere. And I think we kind of look to city council and the county council, for that matter, to where our other levels of government fall down, because it's easier to yell at you than it is to yell at the Minister of Housing. But I did promise we would do a half and half, and as much as I don't know why you'd want to run for a federal seat when we're having so much fun here locally. But I did say I wanted to talk about the other side of what's going on with you politically. And so can you talk about and I know you talked about this when you announced your run, but just for people who, you know, may have forgotten or may not be aware, you know, why are you seeking higher office now? What's the appeal?
Well, I think of other levels of government that have different levers, and I think I can do more for Guelph in Ottawa than I can from a councillor's seat, definitely, because that's where we're seeing the funding for the child benefit, where we're seeing funding for seniors, where we're seeing massive investments directly with municipalities to facilitate housing. And, you know, the recent budget talked about increasing some reaching home funding. They are facilitating both on the market side and on the income side. So for those big blocks to move, I think I want to be part of policy that is going to support people. So I'm seeking the federal Liberal nomination because our MP Lloyd Longfield is retiring. And so I'm asking the people of Guelph to help get me on the ballot for the Liberals. And they can find out more at dominiqueforguelph.ca, and that's for F-O-R. And, you know, I have been nonpartisan for a long time. I have worked for, you know, done training for Elections Canada, Elections Ontario. I'm a centrist. I believe in good public policy. People have seen, you know, me at council bring in value for money audits and motions, et cetera. So I believe in good use of our funds and good public policy. But I also see how federal policy hits cities on the ground mm-hmm. and the lack of provincial action, how it impacts us on the ground. And I would like to be Guelph's voice in Ottawa in terms of negotiating this new deal for cities, because we have a massive role. I'm very concerned with the opposition and their lack of a climate plan mm-hmm. for a city like Guelph. I think that's critical. I'm very concerned about the opposition's protectionism. When they say, bring those jobs home, that's protectionism and it's bad for Guelph.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I'm very concerned about the tone. So I was a House of Commons page and a tour guide and a parliamentary intern. I've been a government relations practitioner, communications person for a long time. We have to get back to a place where we're talking about good public policy, where we believe in data, where we believe experts, and where we're driving good policy, and where we have a broader lens, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see Canada reposition itself in the world. And I can't do that from Ward 6.
Well, that's fair enough. You kind of outlined the stakes a bit about the next election. I would point out, though, and I do find this fascinating, if you are elected, if you become the Liberal nominee and you get elected in 2026, you would be the fourth Liberal MP in 30 years. And I guess, again, you're a political animal. I'm a political animal. We know the impact of optics. For people who be like, you know, 30 years we've had Liberals, you know, what has that gotten Guelph? For the cynics among us, you know, what makes sending Dominique to Ottawa as the next Liberal MP something that should work in their favor?
Well, I think the reason the Liberals have held Guelph for 30 years is in part because it's more of a centrist party. It's because the values resonate. I think, though, that, you know, we want change, except over time, the people representing Guelph have changed. The issues have changed. The context has changed. And so I'm motivated to run for the Liberal Party because they supported people through COVID, right? They have a climate plan. They are taking bold action on housing. And so I think that voters make their choices based on the context at the time, and that context is always changing. Mm. Why me? People know that I am a tireless advocate, that I believe in good public policy, that I will do everything I can to represent them. And for me, this is about values.
Hmm. I find people in your position in elections kind of the most interesting, where you're running to represent the party in power. So essentially you're running as an incumbent, although you had no say in sort of any of the actions that happened in that government. So, you know, you've talked a lot about what the government, the Liberal government, the last 9 years has done right. Is there anything they've done wrong? Is there anything that, you know, if you had been there, just, you know, in supposing that Dominique might have been the lone dissenter in terms of delivering that policy? Is there, like, I guess, in what circumstances do you sort of see yourself outside of the party whip?
Well, I will say that I don't know what I don't know. And okay. I think elected people do their best with the information and the advice they have at the time. And so, you know, here's an example. Maybe procurement during COVID was looser than it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, because I'm not the minister. I'm not the deputy minister. I know that, and I've worked for a provincial government agency before, had a minister announce a program in 6 weeks. So I have some sense of how quickly that has to happen, how the form that you receive has to talk to the database, has to plug into finance, has to do the program delivery. When a minister announces a program, and they announced many during COVID, and things were changing, it was unclear. it was more about the context, but there is a massive amount of work that went on behind the scenes. And, you know, my example is a small government agency. They had to coordinate across multiple departments. And so in retrospect, I think it's easy to say, oh, that should have been done differently. But I think that in the moment when people, you know, could not pay their rent and could not, you know, on their home or on their business, I think the government moved very quickly. I think people were probably pretty grateful for that. Afterwards, was the program design ideal? Was it perfect? Well, I think that was the trade-off between speed and support for people and perfection, right? So we've never seen a global pandemic like that.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to second guess the government's response there.
Is that going to be a big thing? Sorry to interrupt, but just to follow up on that, is that going to be a big thing this election? That, because so many of us have memory hold, like what the circumstances were and how decisions were being made. It all seems like we're all kind of backseat drivers. Like they should have done X, Y, Z.
I went to see last year a film called 2020 and Hope.
Yeah.
And it was about the year 2020. It was about COVID and Black Lives Matter. And in Canada, you know, finding Indigenous children on the grounds of residential schools. And this movie was about an hour and a half. And you walked out of there a bit shell-shocked. We went through really an extraordinary time, people being sort of battered from all sides. I think we're still going through some of that, supply chain issues, global wars. So I hope that people step back and look at the context. But it's hard because we just want to be past that and looking to the future, right?
Yeah.
But I do hope we have time to think about what would a different government have done, and would a different political party have supported Canadians? I don't really want the answer to that. I'm glad that this government supported Canadians through COVID. I'm glad they're bringing in childcare. So the thing about, you know, it's not fully rolled out. The thing about childcare, I think people who are currently paying the higher rates and who get the drop will feel it and appreciate it. But then everybody else who comes into the system is going to believe that's just what childcare should cost.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I'll answer your question in this way. I'm a communications person. I would like to see this government better articulating the benefits that it brought to Canadians, lifting kids out of poverty, lifting seniors out of poverty, the support it gave people through COVID, bringing down income tax for small businesses, those types of things. So as a comms person, you know, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
I think they could have done a better job communicating, but I think they were navigating through the circumstances.
Maybe to wrap up, talking to you as a comms person, what's your concern about the tone of the election? I mean, whether or not you believe in, you know, the policies of the Liberal government, it's a government that's been around 10 years, which automatically has a kind of wear effect. We have an opposition party that is really, really on the offensive in terms of their rhetoric. Does it concern you that the nuances you want to talk about might get lost in the noise?
Sure. Because, you know, I believe in peace, order, good government, governance, accountability, civility, and respect for our institutions. I think it's incredibly damaging, the tone the opposition is taking on policy and on the institution itself. So I'm a big believer in democracy, and I'm going to talk to the electorate. Should I be the successful candidate? Right. So first I need to win the nomination. But I think we need to get to a place where we're able to talk about facts and outcomes and to hear each other and to understand if we disagree, but to still respect the process.
All right. Well, Dominique, I know you always respect this process, and I appreciate that. So Dominique O'Rourke, thank you so much for your time this week.
Thanks, Adam. You take care.
Okay. So once again, that was Dominique O'Rourke. Look for her on a doorstep near you, I guess. I mean, it's nice weather the last couple of days, so good door knocking weather.
Gonna need the shoes resold after.
Yeah, it's true. It's like halfway through Actually, this fall will be halfway through the term. So that's a lot of walking.
Nice to
All
have a
right.
couple of contenders in, though, and
Yeah, no, for
once
sure.
again, we put that out there to anyone who is in those same positions to get in touch.
We'll talk to anyone.
Open invite.
Open invite on open sources. Am I right? That's it for the bad jokes for this week's show. We hope you like them. You could stay connected to our show. You listen to it every Monday by downloading it from our website, opensourcesguelph.com, or on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or through your favorite podcast app like Apple, TuneIn, and Spotify. We're also on the socials, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook and at OS_Guelph on Twitter or X if you like. I will be back here on CFRU Wednesday at 3 p.m. for the movie review show that I co-host called End Credits. And you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or check out my news and politics site at GuelphPolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz. Open your laptop and go to Facebook, Twitter, also X, and Blue Sky. Although I'm not even sure if I'm on Blue Sky anymore. I can't get at it. But anyway, look around. I'm out there somewhere. If you're joining us at our regular time on a Thursday at 5 o'clock, please stay tuned for the volunteer playlist at 6.
Yes, indeed. That is one of the many great programs that you will hear on this station, CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. As for this show, we will return next Thursday at 5 p.m. for another edition of Open Sources, and we will see you then. Thank you.